Okay, so that was an important detour about how to actually measure this program historically and how to cast Medicaid policy in the 60s into a sort of childhood concept of cumulative eligibility through AFDC. But there's a number of reasons why we wouldn't want to just sort of run from there and regress adult outcomes on that measure. For example, AFDC policy changed in very important ways after the 60s, and it could be the case that some part of the measure I just showed you is driven by reforms like happened in 1981. Those reforms may independently really matter for child outcomes, and I don't want to mix that up with what I'm calling Medicaid eligibility. Other changes in demand for low-income labor throughout the 80s and 90s, when AFDC tried to become more connected to imposing different kind of work requirements and more connected to labor markets, that could also matter for kids and really, really drive what I'm actually observing in AFDC rates. Changes in demographics matter, so other changes in single female-headed households would be correlated with AFDC. We know that happened in the 70s and 80s. And then finally, that migration measure that I just showed you, that itself could be correlated with all sorts of other outcomes. It could be that like healthier cohorts that were going to be healthier anyway moved more and moved to different types of states. So there's all these reasons why we might not want to take that thing I just showed you and just put it on the right-hand side of a regression and see how outcomes are relate to it. So instead, what I'm going to do is take one particular measure of AFDC, which is the share of kids on AFDC in your birth state in the year that your state began Medicaid. So I just want to emphasize this AFDC star, which is what we're going to be talking about, is just a direct measure of how high was the jump when your state started in eligibility when your state began Medicaid. This is just the first dot in that cloud. It's right there. So this thing gets measured by race, and this cloud is not by race, but basically I'm saying what we're going to do is take this value for states and just use that all the time. So this is really helpful because it means that I can compare states by this one measure in any year. So you see like New Hampshire is low in this measure, but then it kind of goes, it's not the lowest state anymore up here. So if I used, it would be really hard to make this comparison year by year because the ranking would kind of change. Here I'm just going to say, no, New Hampshire is the bottom here, it's always the bottom. And then I can compare this dot and say New Hampshire's bottom here too. So this is basically the cross-sectional part of a difference-in-difference design where everything I do in the rest of the paper is going to essentially boil down to comparisons of outcomes for different cohorts who were born at different times before and after Medicaid. So that's like the people born 20 years before who were adults, the people born in years where they were exposed as teenagers, the people born in such years that they were exposed as young kids. So I'm going to compare changes across cohorts born in different years, but in states with different values of this initial measure. So some people accumulated eligibility at a much faster rate than others. And so that's the kind of, fundamentally, this is what's going to be compared when I show you these outcomes. And so to believe everything I'm saying, it's going to be really, some of this has come up, but it's going to be really important to know why is a state at the top or the bottom of that cloud? Because it could really easily be the case that states with high AFDC rates are fundamentally different than states with low AFDC rates, and we could come up with all sorts of other stories for why the outcomes for their kids would diverge over time. And so what I'm going to argue basically is that at this time in particular, states found themselves with high or low AFDC rates for lots of kind of long-run historical institutional reasons. It's not something, so differences across states in AFDC was not something that just emerged contemporaneously in the 60s. In fact, those differences were there in the 50s and in the 40s, and some other really interesting work in economic history suggests that states, the way states ran their AFDC programs in the 30s, 40s, is even related to the way they ran mothers' pension programs that predated AFDC. So lots of the differences that we see in AFDC in the mid-20th century actually had their origin in stuff like sort of the pre-existing industrial structure across states. So agricultural states had this big incentive to keep down payments and provide low benefits, and so that leads states with lots of agriculture to have low AFDC benefits and low participation. There was tons of overt racial discrimination in the AFDC program that was obviously not written into the law, but really mattered, particularly for differences in participation for white and non-white families. This was huge, and as Harold mentioned, like largely litigated in the 60s and 70s. The This paper by Carolyn Mayling is the one that establishes a link between mothers' pensions and ADC programs and talks about how the way that states made this choice, you know, in the teens really affects the structure of how these programs worked in after the Social Security Act. And then there's some interesting stuff about the way that different state constitutional structures limited states' abilities to expand spending on social welfare programs. So this is something that would have been in place long before the 60s, but nevertheless really mattered for how some states structured their AFDC programs. And so basically, when I compare cohorts in high or low AFDC states, these things are historically stable, so it's not just something that came from the 60s. It was there long before Medicaid. And it was largely arbitrary with respect to children's circumstances. Many of these factors, you know, even if they mattered for like a little bit of cross-sectional differences, they really weren't mapping strongly to how the circumstances for kids changed in the mid-20th century. So I'll show you that specifically. So there's a lot of ways to put data together to test those claims and to argue that, in fact, like when I compare states by AFDC, that I'm not confounding that with other stuff. So, for example, this figure takes a bunch of information from vital stats data. So infant mortality, birth weight, sex ratio at birth, many other share of births in hospital, and I kind of combine them together in an index, and I can say, well, are these circumstances of health at birth changing for different cohorts in higher or lower AFDC states in the lead up to Medicaid? So each of these dots is like a regression coefficient. That's the interaction of this particular cohort with this AFDC star measure. And so if we were seeing cohorts in high AFDC states getting systematically healthier over time, then this would be a really strongly positively sloping line, and you'd say higher AFDC states are like having better and better and better birth outcomes throughout the 50s and 60s, and that would really confound some comparison before and after Medicaid. But in fact, that doesn't seem to be the case, neither for whites nor non-white infants. Each point is pretty noisy. If I try to put a line through it, that line is not statistically significant. And so this suggests that in terms of this one particular measure, health at birth, AFDC doesn't really predict differences in changes in health at birth over this whole kind of 15-year period prior to Medicaid. I can do the same thing using census data on other kind of SES measures. So this figure is structured the same way. These are coded to be, they're coded to be, bad. If high AFDC states were getting better, these would be falling. But again, doing things like, you know, measuring different points in the child income distribution, child poverty rates, education of the head of parents for 50, 60, and 70, these things are not changing differentially. So again, we're not seeing cohorts of children who are exposed to systematically better or worse circumstances in childhood across this measure. I like showing this because it was a fun data collection effort, but AFDC measure also is not correlated with other kind of public health efforts that would have predated Medicaid. So someone brought this up, and I thought it was a really interesting idea. Since I'll tell you about disability in a few minutes, people say, well, aren't you worried? What about the dissemination of the polio vaccine? That's affecting cohorts born in the mid-50s. We have a clear connection to disability. So had an RA go to the March of Dimes archives in White Plains, New York, and get a bunch of information on how the March of Dimes helped to disseminate the Salk polio vaccine in the mid-50s. And so I can get different measures of that and scatter it against the AFDC measure. So the top is the total number of polio vaccines shipped to different states by 1957, which was a few years after it was first approved. The next is the infantile paralysis case rate in 1945. So this is not polio deaths, it's just like reported polio cases among infants. This is the change in the infantile paralysis case rate, 40 to 50. So this is sort of a trend in polio prior to the vaccine's development. And then this is the change in the polio, any polio rate, pre and post vaccine. So all these measures, you would think, these represent both direct efforts to combat polio, and I think of them also kind of as proxies for other public health stuff that states were doing. And we would be concerned if these things were systematically related to the AFDC rate in different states, because that would say, oh, maybe these states just do more public health stuff. And it seems that they don't. So they don't This isn't correlated with my measure of sort of white child AFDC rates, and it's not correlated with my measure of non-white child AFDC rates either. So again, these states don't seem to be doing different public health stuff, which is good. It turns out that one good thing is that AFDC is strongly correlated with actual Medicaid use. So this is a picture from my previous work where I collected information on participation by state in both Medicaid and in the pre-Medicaid public insurance program. So maybe you'd be concerned that some states just already had generous programs and Medicaid just replaced them and nothing changed. And that doesn't seem to be true. So here I'm taking the sheriff kids getting some kind of medical payment. You can see it's small before Medicaid goes into place. And asking, like, how does that share change when Medicaid goes in high versus low AFDC states when Medicaid is put in place? And you see that high AFDC states have a huge increase in the share of kids who are actually getting some kind of public medical program. So not only is this thing not correlated with a bunch of stuff that you'd be worried about, it's very correlated with the actual thing that it's supposed to measure, which is, do kids actually get Medicaid? And then just to reiterate, my earlier work suggests that not only is it correlated with Medicaid use, but also with contemporaneous child health. Okay. So I won't talk about this too much, but this is just the regression specification. I want to point out that I've been talking a lot about comparing cohorts before and after Medicaid, and so the main results I show you will just be pictures where I'm gonna plot coefficients that are interactions between the AFDC measure that we've been talking about and different dummies for cohorts born in the years leading up to a Medicaid program. So this first sort of sum is basically a direct measure of pretrends. These are dummies for cohorts that are born before Medicaid, and so never should have been exposed to it as children. And so the really important thing there is going to be to look for the sign and the magnitude and significance, and maybe estimate a trend. And these are cohorts where we do not want a relationship between adult outcomes and AFDC rates for cohorts who never actually had any Medicaid. So this thing is a direct falsification test, and we'll plot these things and look at and hope that they are small and flat. Cohorts, the coefficients of interest for cohorts born in the years leading up to Medicaid contain a lot of information about what Medicaid might have done. Because I don't have to impose anything about whether Medicaid matters at age 18 or 16 or 14 or 10. Actually, the data can tell me that directly. Like, all I need to do is say, how do adult outcomes change differentially in high versus low AFDC states for cohorts exposed at this age or this age or this age? And so these coefficients are really going to tell us about when coverage starts to matter and how much. And so I just want to note that cohorts born closer to Medicaid actually vary on two things. They get a higher dose of Medicaid in that that's the cloud is sloping up, and they're exposed at a younger age by definition. So there's actually, unfortunately, no way to really separate those two features in this design. But both things are going to contribute to the estimates I show you as we kind of go look across cohorts and see when the effects really start to phase in. One thing that's important to note is that we actually have another test of this design, which is that eligibility was phasing in as cohorts were born up to Medicaid's beginning, but actually that relationship flattened out after cohorts were fully exposed. And so we can look for a similar kind of kink in this relationship when we have adult outcomes on the left-hand side, because if adult outcomes are getting better and better and better in higher AFDC states for kind of the middle cohorts, they shouldn't keep on getting better and better for the cohorts born fully after, because they have differences, but they're not growing with successive cohorts. So it's another thing we can test in this kind of design, which is very helpful. I'm not going to spend time talking about the other covariates in this model. They might come up with some questions, but I'll just let them come up if people have concerns. Okay, and then finally, before we actually show results, so this has been I spend a lot of time like arguing that the thing I'm going to show you is believable, and now we're on the cusp. So the outcomes that I'll show you in this context are, first of all, a measure of cumulative mortality. So I go to the vital stats data, and for 1979 to 2004, public vital stats data contain a variable for the state of birth of the decedent. And so I can get a count of deaths for kids born, you know, whites born in 1960 or something. How many of those kids died for this 20-year span? And then I just divide that by the population by state of birth in year of birth in 1980. So this is a sort of summary measure of later life mortality, representing sort of 20 years of a mortality experience. Then I can go to the census in ACS and calculate a bunch of health and labor market outcomes, because the census in ACS always asks where you're born. And so again, I can calculate these measures at the state and cohort level. So I'll show you results for disability. So there's a range of self-reported disabilities in the census in ACS, a number of measures for labor supply, and then participation in different public programs. Then I'll show you some stuff about income by source, so to figure out if Medicaid is kind of a long-run anti-poverty policy or not. And then I just want to note, everything here is going to, I just collapsed this all down to averages by the birth state, birth cohort, and race. So for each race, there's basically, I keep about 41 years in 49 states, and so, you know, this is based on a lot of underlying individuals, but the regressions themselves only ever have about 2,000 observations in them. Okay, very briefly, we're going to ask the simple question, which we should kind of have a sense of, which is, does that initial AFDC measure actually predict the migration-adjusted one that we talked about? It might not. I mean, if you thought that the migration really, really was strong and kids from low AFDC states move to high ones or vice versa, you might say, well, maybe the conditions at the start of the program don't actually predict cumulative exposure to it. And then, you know, they do. So there's no relationship between coverage, really, for cohorts that never had any coverage. The effect of sort of being spending one more year in a state with a little bit higher AFDC rate is to have your coverage phase in for these cohorts and then taper off for cohorts born fully after. So this is just verifying a thing that we think should be true, but we needed to check that when I show you results for outcomes, in fact, these are cohorts that really did have more eligibility for Medicaid. Okay, so do initial AFDC rates predict changes in adult health? We're going to roll out the mortality estimates piece by piece. So this is the falsification test for adult mortality. These are cohorts that these people were 30 years old when Medicaid started. They clearly have no childhood coverage. These people were 20 years old, 19, 20 years old. They have no coverage either. And in fact, this relationship is small and flat. It's actually flat, too, for cohorts that were teenagers when they first got coverage. So this is already telling us something about treatment effects. Medicaid doesn't seem to matter in the long run when you only get it as a teenager, at least by this measure. But for cohorts that got Medicaid at younger and younger and younger ages, starting at about age 10, adult mortality rates really start to fall for higher AFDC states relative to lower AFDC birth states. And then afterwards, there's a little bit of a tapering off. And so this is kind of exactly the pattern of results that we would expected, given the way we know cumulative eligibility was phasing in. So this is the mortality result for white adults. And this is the very similar looking result for non-white adults. So this is suggesting that kind of this initial check for a pretty extreme health outcome, cumulative adult mortality, a given amount of childhood eligibility seems to do something quite similar for white and non-white adults. Actually, my preferred measure is this one, which I can explain if you want, but one kind of issue with this mortality measure is that the incidence of the AIDS epidemic being very, very strongly correlated with these cohorts. So cohorts born in the 50s and 60s suffered the brunt of the AIDS epidemic in the 80s and 90s. And it was strongest for non-white men in places like New York and New Jersey. That happens to be correlated with, happen to be high Medicaid states. And so one way to deal with that is to just use some demographic methods to remove the sort of force of AIDS mortality from these estimates and look at similar pictures that aren't in principle affected by AIDS mortality. And actually, they're very similar, but if you notice, just a lot less noisy. Yeah.
How about homicide?
Homicide is in here, but then I can look at it separately, and particularly for whites, it's a flat line. Yeah, I did. I had some kind of first cut pictures using the Roland Fryer crack index, and they weren't that strongly correlated, but there might be better ways to bring it in. That's a good idea. Okay, so this table shows you some numbers that are slightly easier to understand, but I'm not going to argue to your face that this should be obvious to interpret these numbers right away. These are the estimates that where I use, I just calculate a predicted dose of childhood Medicaid eligibility using my kind of initial measure and use it as an instrument. So this is saying the effect of one additional childhood year on adult mortality in terms of log points. And so these are the IV estimates, but I want to go through, so I'll tell you how big those things really are. If I use these estimates to say, well, okay, this is the effect on adult mortality, we can use other data to figure out how many kids from a given cohort had childhood exposure, how much did they have, you can get a sense of how much must mortality have fallen among the subset of a cohort who actually had childhood AFDC participation to rationalize these effects. And that's the number I think we care about. How much did Medicaid affect the mortality of the people that it actually treated? And so it suggests that, for white kids in some other surveys who report, if you look at the PSID and you say, how long did white kids who received any AFDC receive it? On average, it's about 2 years over their whole childhood in different spurts. These estimates suggest that for kids like that, Medicaid exposure would have reduced their adult mortality by about 16%. And for non-white kids, they had more exposure, and so Medicaid would have reduced their adult mortality by about 30%, which is a large number. I mean, this is a big reduction in your mortality risk. But actually, 30% is pretty consistent with what a lot of other contemporaneous studies find about health insurance on contemporaneous mortality rates. So, for example, my short-run mortality stuff actually finds a very similar proportional reduction in the contemporaneous infant and child mortality rate for non-white kids. So this is basically just another number saying health insurance matters, and it matters to a similar degree, and it's reducing mortality in yet another context. So again, for whites, no effect on homicide or accidents. It's noisy, and unfortunately it's negative, but it's noisy for non-whites. And actually, these are spread across a lot of different causes. That historical work I talked about in the beginning that focuses on individual diseases is great because you know exactly what to look for. But Medicaid's a challenge because it just provided medical care, and it could have plausibly affected lots of stuff, and I find that it did. So there are effects for cancer, there are effects for cardiovascular mortality, there are effects, there are noisier effects for lots of different causes. So this is not just coming through one thing. And one thing that actually where it does show up is in suicide. So suicide's not driving the overall result because underlying suicide mortality rates are low compared to other causes of death, but there is a pretty meaningful treatment effect on suicide, which given changes in other kind of chronic illnesses, given the effects I'll show you on disability a little later, I think that this is part of a story about just improving adult health overall, and there might be people whose underlying health puts them in this kind of chronic illness, chronic pain, suicide situation. So it wasn't what I expected when I first ran mortality regressions, but it's something that's pretty robust across specifications. Yeah.
So in the way we've estimated it here, you've estimated it here, mm-hmm. It's like there's large changes in Medicaid eligibility,
yeah.
which we should think about it not just in terms of the addition of Medicaid, but there are also so it could be sort of some things that happen in society in those states as a result of these really big changes in Medicaid. Is that correct?
It could be, yeah. So this is maybe something Colleen was mentioning or we were talking about earlier where, yeah, you could imagine that... So the best analogy I have for this is a story that people tell, like some of the architects of Medicare tell, about how, the week before Medicare went into place, hospitals were crowded with like poor old folks, and they were, they could be really terrible places to be, and then when Medicare went into place and people could go elsewhere, they did, and those hospitals were not nearly as crowded, and that made it easier for people not on Medicare to go to them and get some kind of care. So that could be something like that could have happened with Medicaid, the patterns of care. If the types of places that Medicaid kids were getting care changed, it could have mattered for other kids too. And then maybe you even have other things in mind. So I think that's a good point to mention is that I'm doing these calculations as though the only people affected by this policy change were the kids who had Medicaid exposure. But some of the things you're mentioning suggest that these could be spread across broader groups than that.
And then I also have the notion of like, Your estimates are heavily weighted by like these big states, these states with big increases.
Oh,
right?
I see.
Is that correct? And then different things might be happening in those states.
That's true.
Where I feel less embarrassed to be on Medicaid.
Yeah, no, that could be true. I guess the only thing. Okay, so a couple of things I've mentioned. First of all, some of the balance tests that I showed before suggest that by other measures, those states aren't substantively substantively different than other states. That doesn't mean that Medicaid itself doesn't change things, like you're mentioning. That's a good point. I know what I was going to say. These results also come through when I use like a binary measure of AFDC, so just splitting states at the median, saying high or low. And econometrically speaking, that does take a little bit of the weight off of the highest and the lowest AFDC places. And so the fact that results are also there for a different way to specify my AFDC variable suggests to me that while the highest states matter, these comparisons still generate this type of effect when I'm not comparing the highest to the lowest, and I'm comparing kind of like places that are closer to the middle. So I think your ideas are right, but it's not the case that these are critically dependent on like the highest AFDC versus lowest AFDC places.
So by construction, your treatment group that's getting Medicaid already has AFDC.
Uh-huh.
So in a sense, you can think of it as a sort of an interaction, even though the AFDC isn't changing, right?
Uh-huh.
So your treatment getting Medicaid on top of having AFDC. Does that
yes.
change the way you might think about
that's a good idea.
These results or how they might generalize, or is there some kind of sort of income effect constantly going on that the AFDC enables that just giving
Medicaid. That's a really good question. Certainly the policy implication of that interaction mattering would be that like changes to Medicaid to non-cash transfer families might be totally different than this. That'd be interesting. It'd be interesting to go see if we could figure out. Let's see. So some other folks have done another long-run Medicaid paper using the PSID. Slightly different design, but they've also found long-run benefits in the program. But they've also gone back and cleaned up some surveys of consumer finance that were done starting, I think, in the late 40s that ask about medical debt. And I'm a little skeptical about how those questions are actually recorded year to year, but they have some findings that suggest that the incidence of medical-related debt fell as well. And so that would be one reason that you might... That'd be another angle on this, would be to say... Yeah, maybe financial circumstances matter too. And I think people think that that's important in the 80s as well.
And that might be a reason why you might find some effects in causes of mortality that aren't necessarily related to healthcare, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, so this was the first set of health results for mortality. I can measure it in large samples. It's pretty extreme. It's nice and unambiguous measure of health. Now I'll show you the same type of figure for ambulatory difficulty, which is the variable, it's the census self-reported disability variable that's most common, other than the self-reported work limitation, which I think other disability researchers have been skeptical about how people answer that question. So this is going to be the share of cohorts who say that they have a long-lasting condition that substantially limits their ability to walk, climb stairs, reach, lift, or carry. And so here are the results for whites. There's no reason that these effects across for mortality and disability needed to both phase in right at exposure under age 10. These are totally different data sets, and I was a little amazed that that seemed to happen. And I should also note I'm picking age 10 from sort of like a empirical procedure where I fit a bunch of trend breaks and figure out which break point fits the best, and it's age 10. And so this is telling us a very similar story, that cohorts first exposed to Medicaid at age 10 or younger really have increasingly better health when exposed to more Medicaid, and we have this really sharp kink right here. So I just want to point out, like any other story for why these effects should be there, of which there are many, don't just need to say stuff changed for cohorts in the 60s. They also need to rationalize the fact that then things flatten out for cohorts born here and after. And so to me, this is a pattern that's very hard to pin on things other than Medicaid. So here's the disability effects for non-whites. Actually, they're not in terms their magnitude is not that different. It's just that the effects for non-whites really only phase in at a younger age, and they're a little noisier. So I've had to think about this a little, but yeah. I could. One problem is population denominators for certain things. For the mortality, for example, it's really hard. I peg all this stuff to 1980 because the way that people respond in terms of self-reported race in the census changes in really interesting ways when they're allowed to do more stuff. But the race reporting on death certificates is not nearly so nuanced, because sometimes the funeral director fills out your death certificate, sometimes it's a medical examiner, it's a lot of stuff. So I'm pinning all these very coarse, and I guess I should have said, like, I realize these are extremely coarse race definitions, but it's all pinned, it's all like the lowest common denominator of what I can measure across data sets. But yeah, no, that would be an interesting question. I think maybe others, well, ideas about how to get at that would be very interesting. I don't have a better one. Okay. Okay, so this is the end of, these are the two, I mean, I'm not showing you results for the other self-reported disabilities, but I just want to end the health section before I move on to labor market stuff, that's the end of the talk, and just say, like, these effects represent a lot of lives saved that are worth a tremendous amount of money to individuals if you take even a conservative estimate of, like, value of statistical life from economics literature. And these, you know, the reductions in physical limitations from this disability stuff it's a lot harder to value that, but I think we have really strong priors and some other specific evidence about just how valuable that should be to patients. And just to reiterate, these things are spread across a lot of different conditions and causes. So Medicaid seems to have had its health effects through a pretty broad set of physiological channels that I would love to pin those down in more detail, but it's hard. Okay, so now, so we know that which cohorts were healthier in which ways. They're probably healthier in other ways, but the ones I can measure are mortality and disability. So now I want to show you outcomes for the other kind of labor market stuff in the census and ACS. So this is a picture that should look familiar from the last two, where the outcome in blue is any annual employment. So this is a share of cohorts who just report being employed at all during the year. And the share of cohorts who report getting some kind of disability-related transfer benefit. So that's SSI and SSDI. And again, this is these are the same cohorts and the same data set, but a totally different outcome that didn't need to change right at age 10. But it should be totally clear that the same cohorts who are healthier by both measures in this particular pattern of, like, effects phasing in and flattening out work more and are much less likely to get some kind of disability-related transfer. So this is these are, like, very proximate labor market outcomes to exactly the health stuff that we saw improve. So the story is, cohorts with more coverage are healthier by two measures, and they have higher extensive margin labor supply and get a lot less public transfers for programs specifically related to those kind of conditions. So we can dig into that a little more, and I'll just show you some of these effects by subtype. So the picture, this maroon line was for any disability-related transfer. That goes down more than total public assistance does, because some subset of people, and this is driven by women, are less likely to get a disability benefit but more likely to get other benefits, which is basically TANF or, just in some states, maybe general assistance. And, you know, that makes sense, because if you're eligible for both, you definitely want SSI or SSDI. But if you stop being disabled, it doesn't mean you're not eligible for another transfer program. So there's some kind of actual shift. It's not just a pure story of reducing transfers. For some subset of people, it's a shift from one type to another. And then there's also kind of intertemporal effects within the public insurance system. So by virtue of not getting SSDI, a lot of these cohorts are much less likely to get Medicare associated with their SSDI or Medicaid associated with SSI. And so public insurance falls a lot. But because we saw they're employed, it's not like a huge reduction in any insurance, although it is a little bit. It's mainly just a reduction in the share of people who are on some kind of public insurance program. These are the different kinds of employment outcomes, but you saw the one for any employment, so none of these are all that surprising. It's just worth noting, most but not all people are in some kind of full-time, full-year employment, but that's by no means the entire effect. Okay, so the last thing I'll show you from the census is my best attempt to figure out what this is doing to income. And so this is how I'm going to motivate it. You could imagine, so like we showed all these event study pictures for many different outcomes. You could imagine just taking the income variables and creating a bunch of different measures and saying, what's the probability that you earn greater than zero? That's the navy line with open circles. And of course, that looks just like the employment line, because earning a positive amount is any annual employment. But you could just move that threshold up the income distribution and say, well, what's the probability that you earn $10,000 or more, $20,000 or more, or $100,000? So what we see is that Medicaid is having sort of a decreasing effect on those outcomes. And by the time you get to say, do you earn $100,000, childhood Medicaid has no effect on whether members of your cohort earn $100,000 or not. And so what I'm going to show you in the next picture is I wanted to show you these to tell you where this comes from, but what I'm going to plot for you is these effect sizes that say what is the impact of one additional year of cohort level eligibility on the probability of earning different points throughout the whole distribution. So this is where they come from, but I'm going to plot the whole distribution for you here. The top line is just plotting the effect on the distribution of earnings. And since we know people work more, it shouldn't be surprising that earnings go up. But what you can see is that the increase in earnings is very concentrated at low levels of earnings, which makes sense because this was a program that targeted poor kids in the 60s in the U.S. with low intergenerational income mobility, so they're not high-earning adults. New disability benefits fell, so transfers fall, but you know nobody gets transfers more than... Transfers aren't that high, so there's no effect at high levels of transfers. But what's really interesting about this picture is that total income's not all that different. So, I mean, people were way better off in terms of their health, but they're actually not significantly better off in terms of material well-being. And so this is suggesting that Medicaid's long-run effects are big, and they matter a lot in terms of physical well-being, but it's not really a long-run anti-poverty program. Another take on this is that the disability insurance system works pretty well. This is exactly what it's supposed to do. So when people aren't disabled anymore, they work a little bit, and this is how it's supposed to go. So there's a lot of other discussion out there about DI and how it works and what its issues are. And this suggests that that it's actually doing its job. So the last thing I want to show you is how I use these numbers to figure out not what this does financially for individuals, which I just showed you isn't a ton, but what it does for the government. Because actually, those changes in the composition of income, more earnings and lower benefits, the government benefits from both of those things. So basically, this sums up to $21 billion in savings today. Because of the behavioral responses of these cohorts. So there's a little bit of increase in tax revenue. I mean, these are low earnings, so they're not taxed that heavily. But the federal tax revenue goes up by about $6 billion a year. A little bit of benefit from people not spending on Medicare, which I don't get it in the census, but I'm imputing it from some other spending information on Medicare, disabled Medicare beneficiaries. And then a big benefit to the government of not paying out DI benefits to these cohorts. So the government saves like $12 billion a year from that. And if I compare that to what I estimate from sort of my historical data collection on what it cost to cover these cohorts for their childhoods, it suggests that they cost about $132 billion. And you could divide one by the other, but the one really hard problem with that is that the cost and the benefits are separated by 50 years. So unfortunately, in this case, discounting really, really, really matters. So if you do the typical econ thing and you say discount rates are 3%, then we earned a huge return on this $132 billion every year, and in fact, we've totally paid for the program. That's not my preferred strategy here, because lots of the spending took place in like, the late 70s, early 80s, when interest rates were really high. And in fact, Office of Management and the Budget, when they do these cost-benefit projections, they're mandated to use Treasury rates to discount costs and benefits. And when you do that, you get a much lower return. But still, it's a pretty significant, meaningful return per year, and it suggests that if you just add up the savings in the years of this study, which is very conservative because they could have been accumulating before, or almost certainly accumulating after, it suggests that we've earned back 28% of what we spent on the program originally. And this is just from the government's point of view, not building in the value of any of those health benefits. So that's the end.
Thanks
very much.